Aldo Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State. And he also manages a 2,000-acre organic farm in North Dakota that's been in his family for three generations. He brought together people who are developing new varieties of foods, mostly grains and vegetables, some fruits, in the way that should address a number of the things that Andy and Winona have talked about, that would be more sustainable. But the challenge is that some of them have different tastes, and so we need to get the chefs involved to introduce these tastes to people so that the food will then become part of the ordinary consumer choice. And I think that that's sort of ties in with a lot of what you're going to tell us about, why chefs are so important to advancing the food system. Thank you.
You can stay here. I like having you.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth.
Hi.
I am the Director of Food Safety and Sustainability for Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich. I recently also took on workplace safety, which is interesting because what Winona was talking about with the hemp thing, I also thought, you know, pushing through all those chickens is not safe for the workers. But also, Director of Food Safety, Sustainability, and Workplace Safety no longer fits on my business card, so I am in the market for a new title if anybody has any ideas. Also, just full disclosure, I did come here. My grandmother just passed away. I'm very sad about that. So I didn't get as much time to practice, so bear with me. But also, my grandmother used to approve all my outfits, so I'm a little bit self-conscious about what I chose. I hope everybody... and I did find a typo as well, which I'm pretty upset about, but I'm not here to talk about this. But also, I was thinking, after going after these two very well educated and academic speakers, I was on a panel. I sat through a panel once with a chef who was between two speakers like this, and she said, clearly I'm the cream in this academic Oreo cookie, and that's sort of what I feel like today. So I'm going to try. But I am here to talk about Meatless Monday. I'm not a Meatless Monday expert, but I think you know, my role is to sort of show, I mean, not necessarily the private sector that we've been speaking about, but how you can be a positive role in the private sector. And obviously, we are a version of the private sector. Speaking about Meatless Monday, Sid is in the audience here, but he told me I could say whatever I want. Nobody would know. But I am going to tell the truth. Meatless Monday started in 2003 with Sid. He was a big wig in the... can you guys hear me okay, by the way? I feel like I'm... Okay. In advertising, together with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He learned that excessive fat consumption linked directly to heart disease, stroke, and diabetes, and that the average Americans consume 8 ounces of meat per day, which is 45% more than the USDA recommends. I'm sure at this conference you have probably heard that 500 times already. But that a 15% decrease in meat consumption, as we talked about, you know, the 21 meals you eat during the week. If you take three of those out, that's one day. Not to mention reducing our carbon footprint and saving precious resources like water, which I think my two fellow panelists have already discussed. But what I didn't know, which I think is the fascinating part about this, is that the idea from this genius advertising executive came from the wartime rationing of Meatless Mondays and Wheatless Wednesdays. I found this great poster. Meatless days, wheatless days, porkless days. Does anybody else know that? No, I didn't know that. I thought it was great. You're a genius. And that turned into Meatless, what we know, now know as Meatless Mondays. Am I speaking too fast? Okay, good. Yes. The Meatless Monday constituency says yes. There's 200 participants in the U.S. restaurants, including campuses, K-12 schools, hospitals, cafeterias. And then the city of Los Angeles is the largest city that participates, as well as San Diego, D.C., and San Francisco. And, of course, some famous people, Paul McCartney, Richard Branson, Oprah Winfrey, Lori David, Michael Pollan, among others. So the concept behind Meatless Monday, when I proposed it to Mario, was, you know, we just have to offer, you know, a vegetarian option, one or two vegetarian options every Monday, right? And he said, very simple, no-brainer. you don't have to only serve vegetarian options on Monday. You don't have to, but you do, we made it very clear, you cannot just take a salad and make it an entree-sized salad. It has to be a vegetarian entree. So when I first said this to everybody, they said, you mean the guy with sausage around his neck? Because this is a very famous photo. He's going to do meatless Monday. And I always say yes, but he was also the guy photographed with the radishes on his head for Time magazine, and nobody ever remembers that photo. So if you aren't familiar with our restaurants, we have these various restaurants in New York, L.A., and Vegas. We do participate in meatless Monday at all of these restaurants. So in order to prepare for this presentation, I did try. Also, we made our own logo, the Batali Bastianche Meatless Monday logo. I did pull some examples of some of the dishes that we do and how we promote this. We are a chef-driven restaurant, so we said we gave the chefs the option to do, you know, something that would work for them. And that was very successful. Again, we just said it has to be a vegetarian entree. It just can't be something that you doubled in size as an appetizer. That being said, a lot of our restaurants are pizza restaurants or, you know, pasta main course restaurants. Some place like Osteria Mozza in L.A. created an entire vegetarian pasta tasting menu in honor of Meatless Monday. And some restaurants put the logo on there, some verbalize it, some hand out a special card. And then I went through, these are the really good shots, and I pulled some numbers for the month of September. Now, at first the numbers are going to maybe not seem, some will seem impressive and some won't. So Pizzeria Mozza did 54 Meatless Monday pizzas in September. Lupa in New York did 67 Meatless Monday pizzas. You guys are going to eat lunch after this, right? Yeah? Okay. And Ozo Las Vegas did 200 Meatless Monday pizzas in September. Then I was very proud of myself. I made a graph. Oh, did you guys see the typo, by the way? It was back in the other. Okay. Showing you that, you know, depending on, it's interesting. I picked one restaurant from each location, Vegas, L.A., and New York. And then I broke it down into percentage, what percentage each restaurant was selling. So at first I was like, that's not, I was pretty disappointed. I didn't think that was very much. But then, and this is just the covers that the restaurants are doing, so you can see, we can go back to the slides if anybody wants. Then I went through and I picked out some of the most popular dishes from these restaurants. And Pizzeria Mozza's most popular pizza is pizza margherita. And they sell 10% of that dish. So it's not really that, you know, when you think about it, that's obviously the most wildly popular pizza, also vegetarian, by the way, but it's not that wild a discrepancy when you think about it, if this is a special. Same thing with Lupa. Their most popular pasta, they sell 9.3%, and they sell 1% of the Meatless Monday. And at Ozo Las Vegas, there's barely a percentage discrepancy at all. They sell about 2% of the Meatless Monday pizza and 3% of the pepperoni pizza. And you get to look at some more pretty pictures of our food. So how do we do this? How did I get the buy-in? As we talked, I think, my fellow panelists talked a lot about factory farming, but we do a lot of staff training. If you haven't seen the Meatrix, I've been learning a lot about active listening also. Yes, have you seen the Meatrix? Yay, okay. We show the Meatrix. We hand out things to our chefs, things like the Environmental Working Group's Meat Eater's Guide, if the chefs want information about where and how to purchase. Again, we're a chef-driven restaurant. The guys come to me. I don't send them what they can and can't buy. If they want to know something, they call me. Can I purchase this? What do you think of this? Lamb from New Zealand, this from wherever. It's an ongoing conversation. We let them taste everything. Somebody was asking earlier, what does the director of sustainability do? Do you just taste, this tastes sustainable. Maybe I should try it again. So we taste it, they can promote it. One of the interesting things about Meatless Monday, and one of the things that I think is so successful and why Mario likes it, if you put on the menu that this is the Meatless Monday dish of the day and somebody orders it, it's been a success. If somebody orders the Meatless Monday dish and they don't know it's Meatless Monday, but you then tell them, you just ordered the Meatless Monday dish, it's still successful. They don't have to order it because it's Meatless Monday. You can promote it, you know, after the fact. The message has still gotten across. And that's, you know, a great way to promote something without having to, you know, you have to order this. You can still get the message across without them having to choose it because of what it is. We're also all green certified restaurants, so it's a larger buy-in, right? I put some pictures of other things that we do. We have paper or compostable straws, and we do straws only upon request. We don't serve bottled water. A little water bottle. We might. Sid gave me my I Love New York water. We have, you know, low flow aerators and spray valves, and we compost, among other things. Oh, and that's Vespa, my dog, who listens to me practice these presentations, so I always like to give her credit. That's what she looks like after the fifth time I'm like, you know, go through these things. But that's it.
Chile, Brazil, and Colombia, Bolivia had been suppressed, and small farmers hadn't been really of cheap food in the global system over the last 30, 40 years, persuaded by sort of free market sort of logic and during the regulators, suddenly realized that that cheap food is no longer going to be available and that they're going to be subject to kind of price spikes over time. And they needed to figure out how to, if there were hookups to a country like, say, Taiwan or Japan or Singapore, they needed to figure out how they could get land somewhere else where there was land surplus to produce food to export back to their own country. So a lot of this land grab phenomenon today is not something that's about large farmers in a particular country, like a Colombia or a Chile, consolidating holding. It's actually about whole countries trying to figure out how they can go to another country in another part of the world and lease 10,000, 100,000 acres, consolidate that holding, and then produce off it to ship food back to their own country, which then displaces, which actually creates food security for the country in which that land grab has actually occurred. So it's all part of the problem, plenty part of the globalization process. It's a very different phenomenon than what we saw back in the case of the Cuban strike.
So, Winona?
You know, I think when you look at the hunger issues and the famine that happened in 2007-2008, we also need to think about other things that we can do here to affect these larger issues. The U.S. actually sets the price of commodity crops, of grains. And the reason that the famine happened wasn't that there wasn't enough food. In fact, there was plenty of food. It was a distribution and an income issue. We need to be able to make sure that that kind of speculation doesn't happen in the future. I would urge you all to read the book. Fred Kaufman published it about a year ago. It's called Bet the Farm. And it talks about these fundamental issues that have to do with the production of commodity crops and how it actually affects people in their day-to-day lives around the world. Now, one of the things that we could do here to affect how grains are priced in other countries is to have a grain reserve. You know, China's had a grain reserve since 1854. We had a grain reserve beginning in the 1930s as part of the New Deal. It worked really well. It made money even. But in the mid-1990s, with the trade deals and the pressure by those food processors, the grain traders, the meat industry for cheaper grains, the grain reserve was eliminated. I think that's one of the things that environmentalists, people who care about poverty around the world, and a lot of the issues related to how we overproduce grains here, that in the next version of the Farm Bill, you know, who knows what will happen with the mess that we have today, we need to start talking about some of these issues that seem a little wonky, but when you break them down, they really can impact in a very important way whether people can afford to have food in the global south, in the developing world, and can impact our meat industry here, because cheaper grains means that these factory farms are more cost effective. So there are a lot of reasons that I think we should be advocating for a grain reserve in future farm bills. And you know, I think people get it. I've been traveling around with my book for the last, really the year, and I always talk about the grain reserve. People actually get a grain reserve. Maybe we can have a session at APHA next year on the grain reserve.
Well, maybe just one fact to kind of also consider an area of ration is that 40% of the corn in the United States goes into your gas tank with ethanol. So grain reserves and dealing with and trying to remove the connection between future energy and food would go a long way toward improving the variety and the size of surpluses we have available. So sometimes we make that connection, but I think a lot of it is about connecting these dots.
Elizabeth, we often think of fine dining and good food as being part of the supply chain that you're trying to address consumer demand, but
Monday in particular, but I do know that all of those practices cumulatively, you know, being part of the Indian Restaurant Association, integrating meat with Monday, they all affect your purchasing. So you're potentially purchasing more of which will have the restaurant. Worldwide, but right here, in the U.S., in little
many of the studies that of these small farmers show that, in fact, they are productive. They are, in fact, more ecologically conscious. They manage biodiversity quite well. They manage water quite well because they're dealing in a world of scarce resources. So a lot of what we're trying to do here is shift the focus to small farmers and family farms, and also the conditions of laborers in the field as well as in factory settings around the world, and actually get these companies to accept what are the gold standards of oversight of their supply chains on both labor conditions and investment in small farmer labor, and also attention to women, which tend to be in the special labor that then tends to be overlooked. So it's there, and I think there'd be a variety of different ways.
I'm here.
So the person from Austin, I was just wondering if when you talk about land drivers and that policy, have you applied that to the development of land in the United States, or are you mainly looking at other countries? And I ask that because I know that because of the price of corn, that land is being bought up within the United States, and it's consuming the water resources for migratory birds, and that's a real concern for environmentalists, and that has happened here. Again, because of turning water resources into tillable land.
Well, just quickly, the focus of the Buy the Bread is really more in the international context, because the land grab situation there is about, for example, Saudi Arabia, which is running out of water. They're doing 100% of irrigation in Saudi Arabia. It's now going to Ethiopia and leasing or purchasing, it might be 50,000 acres of land in one go. I mean, these are not 200-acre farms. They're like massive holdings, and they're in areas that are irrigated. So in other words, the Ethiopians are losing all this land because it's going to be exported, it's going to be used for export food in Saudi Arabia. They're losing the best land in the irrigated areas to the foreign investors coming in. And that's the phenomenon we're seeing all over the place. So this is sort of a unique case where it's like large-scale holdings and access to water by foreign holders that are undermining the rights of farmers in those countries. In the U.S. case, we actually looked at this issue in connection with the farm bill that Winona spoke about, because we've been fighting farm bill issues over the last 2 or 3 farm bills. And what we've realized is the subsidy question in agriculture, agricultural subsidies have been actually favoring large farm owners and driving sort of family farm out of business. So the ag bill is not operating against the small family farm in the United States, not in favor of it. And encouraging the kind of land consolidation here that uses, you know, I think you're very adequately described. I think another one's going to get more.
Well, I'm going to address this because I think that the subsidies actually benefit the very top of the food chain. And that would be the grocery industry that's driving a lot of the consolidation in the U.S. When you have Walmart, 1 out of 3 grocery dollars is spent at Walmart, and the other 3 chains that control 50% of the grocery industry in this country, and 70% to 90% in suburban and rural markets. They are pressuring the suppliers for cheaper products. These are the same set of companies, these 20 food processing companies that control 60% of grains in the U.S., that pressured in the mid-90s to deregulate foreign policy, to basically allow as many commodities to be grown as possible, put millions of acres back into production. And then the subsidies are kind of a symptom of that. And we hear a lot about the subsidies, but we could get rid of the subsidies tomorrow and might in this version of whatever comes out of the food, of the farm bill, but we'll still have a dysfunctional food system because it's a lot deeper than that. And it is driving consolidation of farms because most farmers aren't making a very good living. The average mid-sized farmer who has sales between $200,000 and $500,000 makes just under $20,000 a year. And so it's only that very top echelon, about 100,000 corporate farms. And even those, the average take-home is a little over $200,000. But when you look at these big companies like Nestle prices here in the U.S., which is going to be it's a major bubble, and we're working with some of the farm groups, the progressive farm groups, and the National Family Farm Coalition on this issue, because it is a real problem in the Midwest and southern United States.
Should drive up the land, the taxes on land, which then the small farmers can't pay. And the other issue, just on farm labor, since one of the questions was raised earlier, one of the interesting things we see also is with more and more pressure on these corporations to increase shareholder value, they're driving the pressure down on the growers, the large growers, who are then driving pressure down on the workers. So in the United States, we have not seen increases in salaries for farm labor, in the workers in the field, and many of them are immigrant labor, in literally the last 10 or 15 years. And for the first time, I think, in many, many years, we have court cases on slavery in the United States federal courts because of mistreatment of farm labor in the United States because of these incredibly low wages on the farm, driven by downward pressure from the companies that are trying to increase shareholder value.
I can't resist saying that the downward pressure from the companies, it means in their figure. I recently saw
the fact that